On here, we're dealing in Roman numeral 6 with the methodology and purpose of the book. We recognize we finished up, or we're actually working on point D, that it's here. First, the book is in the canon and should be, and it's designed in large measure for positive believers who are younger, but obviously that will not certainly limit it, its ability to impact or to help or edify older believers who will, in many cases, say, yes, I've done that, and he's right, that doesn't work. Or no, I hadn't thought of it that way. And so, obviously, it will edify all believers, even though the primary target audience may have been younger believers. And so we finished up with point D, his observations about the nature of things should serve as a source of encouragement when younger people are going to encounter these things out there in the world that are difficult, that are frustrating, that are unfair and gross in some levels, and they're going to see that they're going to run into their share of fools, they're going to run into their share of idiots, they're going to run into their share of evil out there, and so this is a good, a sound instruction for the fact that, number one, these things exist, and so don't be surprised when you find them, and there is a plan of God behind all of this. That is one of the interesting things that we will, I think I've mentioned, but we'll point out again. And that is that Solomon never uses the personal name for God. He only talks about God in a very generic sense. But it's not because, again, some have suggested Solomon's writing like an unbeliever sees the world. That's not true. He references God some 40 times in the book, so it's not like he's an unbeliever. There are no issues in here about salvation. About sanctification, about spiritual growth in that sense, because these are all things that Solomon would have taken for granted. He would have understood, and we know he would have understood them. And so in that regard, the closest he comes to issues about that would be the comments about fearing God and how to handle oneself in the Christian life, we might say. So when young people see this stuff, they're going to say, yep, Solomon said this, you know, all this, he said, okay. And one of the things I think that comes out of the book, too, that it stands out to me anyway, is this idea of have some fun in life. Life is quick. Life is fleeting. Enjoy life with the recognition that you have a God you're going to answer to. And if God blesses you with something, obviously Solomon had great blessings in the physical realm. And so he had fantastic amounts of money and time and residences and all the things that people would think make for happiness. And he never appears to have felt guilty about having any of these things. So we also recognize that pursuit of these things doesn't make people happy. That's another thing that will come out. But that what God gives you, rejoice in. Have some capacity for it. Enjoy it. And recognize that life goes by quick. I mean, again, it's not until you get somewhat older that you start to recognize how fast it does go by. And so how do you want to spend the days of your life? This book gives us some good instruction on that. Well, two, since life is filled with evils, many beyond our control, a secondary purpose is found in the latter half of the book, which offers practical advice on how to minimize the vanity of life. If life is indeed vain, as he has asserted at the beginning of the book, are there ways to minimize this? And in some ways, we'll see as Solomon works through this treatise about life that he kind of moves slowly and progressively away from the concept that life is short and vain and stupid and worthless and pointless to more of a thought of life is short, and so you should enjoy it. And he moves sort of from this negative view of life that he starts out with, to a more positive view of life. If life is indeed short, and it is, it's transient, it goes by quickly, that can either be depressing, or you can say, carpe diem, seize the day. And it depends on how you look at it. And at some level, Solomon moves from a more negative view of the bad things in life to a recognition that, well, yeah, these things exist, but so what? Life is to be lived. And then you get into, again, very difficult questions of how specifically do you define life? What is life? And one of the things that he does deal with is these fleeting, ephemeral concepts. How do you grab joy in your hands? How do you seize joy? Can't. He said, in some ways, these things are like trying to grab the wind. How are you going to hold the wind in your hands? How are you going to stop it? You can't. It's something that's beyond your control. Well, three here, he does not attempt to water down or ignore the more difficult issues of life. He wants his readers to recognize that this is the way it is under the sun. Now, that's a very common phrase that's used throughout this book as well, under the sun. So under the sun talks about the world as we can see it, as we live in it, as we observe it. It doesn't bring God into the picture per se. Now, he will a couple of times use the phrase under heaven, but that's very minimal in this book. And I would see the distinction between the two phrases, under the sun being that which we can see and perceive and observe. So it makes no assertions. Life under the sun would make no assertions about life after death. It would make no assertions. All we see under the sun is that people live and people die. And that's all we can say about it, effectively from an empirical, rational viewpoint. There's what we see. People live and people die. What happens after death? Under the sun, you can't say. Now, we have greater revelation. Solomon certainly believed in life after death. Some will say, well, Solomon was pessimistic and he didn't believe in life after death. No, yes, he did. He knew about the resurrection. He wasn't stupid. But he intentionally writes about it in some ways as if it doesn't exist. To point out to people, well, is this all there is? This begs the question. If you eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And once we die, who knows what's after us? Well, what we do know about life, what we have seen under the sun, is that life goes by quickly. When you die, people forget you just as quickly. You're not going to be remembered. Nobody's going to care. And if you accumulate a great deal of money and details and all of that, you're going to leave them to somebody else. That much we do know. We can comment on that intelligently. And who knows if the person you leave them to is going to be an idiot and go out and squander all your hard work. Well, very well could be. Proverbs 5:8, if you see oppression of the poor and the denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. So there's a chain of command. There's reasons why things are the way they are. But don't be stunned by all this. People, again, in youth, they tend to be naive and they tend to be crusaders. Oh, I see oppression. I want to fix it. Can you fix all the oppression in the world? You know, people, we want to solve the problem of hunger. How are you going to feed all the poor? You can't. The poor you have with you always, Jesus said. So there are certain realities that govern life that we can't do anything about. And so why get wrapped around the axle about it? It's like the issue with the conspiracy in the last days. The elite super rich as they manipulate the world, manipulate economies and manipulate nations and all of this. And human life to them is insignificant in some way in the big picture because it doesn't, you know, 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 get slaughtered, so what? Our plans are advancing. We're moving on. Humans are considered in some cases to be expendable in all this. And just so much, we call it collateral damage. Oh, well, there's this collateral damage. We just lost a country. Oh, that's big, no big deal. But how long and how much can you concentrate on all of that and get wrapped around the axle about it? Sure, it's true, but isn't it largely beyond your control? To be informed about it is one thing. To be obsessed with it is quite another because you can't do anything about it. How are you going to change all this? Other than pray for, all I do is pray for protection from it, that whatever they're doing, and you're not always going to know what they're doing because there's so much disinformation and misinformation and all of that. You're not going to get it from the mainstream media. They don't even mention stuff in certain cases. Well, okay, so you're aware of it, but I would take the cue from Solomon here. Don't be shocked. Don't be stunned by all of this. The Bible has prophesied it in James there, the elite rich. Well, while his primary audience may have been his son and or younger believers, his work has relevance for the wider audience of positive believers. F. Solomon's writings must be understood against the backdrop of the fall of mankind and the effects it had on man and his world. One, Solomon acknowledges that life is filled with frustrations, inequities, and many variables that lead to a sense of vanity. Two, Solomon wants his readers to understand that the world has been subjected to futility, resulting in certain frustrations for the human race, as per Romans 8:20. Where Paul succinctly sums up what Solomon's going to take a lot of words to say. or to point out that the world, there's something wrong with it. There's something very, very wrong out here. And for the negative cosmos out there, there's this elephant in the room that they refuse to acknowledge. And that is that the human condition is messed up. Oh no, you can solve your own problems. Just listen to Dr. Phil and Oprah. They'll solve all your problems for you. Or just see Judge Judy. You know, good grief, there's something wrong in the world. There's something, you know, there's something very, very wrong, as Bill Murray would say. And why don't people acknowledge this? Why won't they admit that we can't solve the human problems? Why? And it's like they just, oh, but no, you can evolve and you can become your own God and you can have inner tranquility and become one with the universe and oh, hogwash. No, you can't. Show me somebody who's done that. No, you can't. And in some ways, as you study this book and you read about the futility of life, it reminds me of that. And many things came to my mind when I'm studying this book, but one of the things is Groundhog Day. Every day you get up and it's the same day over and over and over again. And one of the things that movie showed very well, I thought, is that the selfish, self-centered person who's doing it for himself gets nothing out of life except this endless sense of frustration. And the person, and you see in this movie where he turns this corner in his thinking. And he says, you know, I'm not doing it for me anymore. You know, you'd see the scene, if you remember the movie. He sits there and he counts down 3, 2, 1, and he goes and robs the armored car because they're not paying attention. And, you know, and he does this stuff. And then he finally gets so depressed he kills himself any number of ways. He finds new ways to commit suicide. And but that expresses the existential frustration of life as it's viewed as just same old every day. And then he turns his corner in his thinking where he realizes it's not all about me. And he begins to think about other people and he learns to play the piano. Not for his own enjoyment. He entertains other people. And he stops and helps him, you know, jacks up the car and changes the tire for the old women. And all this stuff. Well, he becomes a different guy. Well, guess what? Then life takes on a whole new meaning for him. Then it's not just the same old every day. Because he's not in it for himself anymore. But there's something wrong out there in the world. It's a sick place. And Romans 8:20 kind of sums it up. For the creation was subjected to futility. By the way, that word futility there is mataiotes in the Greek. And this is the Greek word that they use to translate hevel, which is Solomon's word for vanity. The word here, if you use Solomon's lingo, the creation was subject to vanity. And this is the subject of Solomon's book, the vanity. All is vanity. There is this, and a matter of fact, that phrase, vanity of vanities, is a superlative in the Hebrew. It's the way you express a superlative. The supreme frustration, the supreme vanity, the supreme futility of it all. And that's what he's saying here. So it was subject to futility, not willingly. Now, and how did all this happen? We know this happened as a direct fallout of the fall of man. That's what brought this to the way it is. But because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will also be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And the very fact that the world out there is this vain, empty place that life just goes on and it's tedious and all of that. Shouldn't that cause, in a normal, positive person, doesn't that cause you to want something better? Isn't this designed to beg the question, isn't there something better? Is this all there is? What if this, Jack Nicholson, what if this is as good as it gets? You know, and that guy, and that was another movie that expresses the vanity of life when you're a self-centered jackass. That movie. And the idea is, what if this is as good as it gets? Well, shouldn't this cause the human race to kind of look around and say, God, is there anything better? And this whole vain world in which we live should cause people to seek something better. I want something better. I want something else. Are you just willing to subject yourself to that same old day in, day out vanity? Well, three, in fact, the Greek term mataiotes, futility, frustration, or emptiness, is found in Romans, is used by the translators of the Septuagint to translate the Hebrew term hevel. And I don't know why my fonts were changed on the Hebrew. Those are supposed to be bigger. I changed them in the document afterwards, but the Hebrew won't always be that small. I use it at like 18 points so you can see it better. But it's used to translate that term hevel, vanity. So four, Solomon's Bible would have consisted only of the Pentateuch, Joshua, Judges, Job, and anything that had been recorded by the time of David, the Psalms, and possibly the book of Samuel. So five, no doubt Solomon was a student of the Old Testament. With the Bible he had, we would assume he was a student of it. I don't have any reason to believe that he wasn't. And many of his observations and conclusions seem to be rooted in the book of Genesis. A, God created the world with regular and observable cycles, Genesis 1, 8, and 22. And again, Genesis 1, for those who don't know, everybody should by now, but if you don't, this is a history of restoration. This is not original creation. It didn't take God 7 days to create the world, or even six. God spoke the universe into existence in a moment of time. Then the world at the fall of Satan was judged, particularly the earth was judged. As that's set out for us in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. That is original creation right there. How did he do it? Spoke it into existence in a moment of time. And then what you have, the earth became, the word translated was there is a translation of hayah, but there is no to be verb in Hebrew. That's an important point to remember. That in Hebrew, when you see a sentence, if it says, you know, John was rich, it'll just say John and rich. You have to supply the to be verb because there is no to be verb, as it were, in the Hebrew language. Hayah means to become. Now, it does double duty because once something becomes something, it is that. The man became rich. Well, he's rich. But is the idea he became rich entered into that state or that he is rich, period? Well, the idea was that he became rich. Well, that God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth is singled out. The earth became formless and void. Formless means that it's the topography of the planet looked the same no matter where you... It was like if you go to Antarctica, and it all looks the same. It's just all white. This was in fact, what the world would have looked like. Was the whole place looked like Antarctica. A formless place that looked the same no matter where you looked, because it was covered with water and frozen. That covers the formless, and void means void of inhabitants. There had been inhabitants on the earth. This verse documents that. Who were those inhabitants? Well, as it turns out, it was Satan and the third of the demons that rebelled with him. Satan was apparently set up his kingdom here. And the formless and void and darkness was over the surface of the deep. It talks about these deep, massive waters that covered the earth, and there was no light and no heat, so therefore we know what happens to water under those circumstances. It's frozen. And so the earth was packed in an ice ball, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the deep, and so God begins to unthaw this situation and reverse what he had judged. Satan was ejected from the planet, and Satan determined he was going to rule over planet Earth. This is the premier planet in all the universe, by the way. It is the only planet capable of sustaining life. And so Satan wanted this planet. Well, it was God's law and rule from ever, and it was a part of the divine decrees, that a man was going to rule over planet Earth. And that's not going to change. And that's what we see in Revelation there with the establishment of the kingdom, that it's going to be through the Lamb of God. It's going to be through the God-man. So Satan is ejected. The earth is judged. And then God takes 6 days to restore it. He provides for a seven-day week. Why? Well, this is instructive as well. We have a regular seven-day cycle now we call a week. Why aren't there 6 days in a week or eight or 12? Because God wanted seven. And he set this week up to establish, to make a point. And it is to reflect his plan for the entirety of human history, in fact. You have 6 days of work and 1 day of rest. 6,000 years of human history to resolve the issues of the angelic conflict. 1,000 years, the millennium at which the earth is at rest. and the issues are largely resolved by then, although not entirely. Here you have this God created the world with regular cycles, Genesis 1:8. God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, there was morning, a second day. A regular cycle of day and night, a regular cycle of a seven-day week, regular cycle of months and years and all of that. And we can see this. And you see that alluded to, well, also verse 22 here in the same one. Where are we at? Or pardon me, 8:22. I was going to say 1:22 didn't make any sense. 8:22. And while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, i.e. summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. Regular observable cycles that will not change. And Solomon alludes to that. Again, we're going to be jumping back and forth, so you might want to put a mark in Genesis there or something. And he alludes to that in Ecclesiastes 1, 2 through 7. I know from time to time, I know we're doing the book of Ecclesiastes. If I say Proverbs, bear with me. I'm not an idiot. I may be an idiot, but that's just a slip of the tongue is all it is. I know what book we're in. So if I say Proverbs, don't, you know, crucify me. Or quit, don't go negative because he said Proverbs and he meant Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does a man have under the sun? Verse 4, a generation comes and a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises again. Blowing toward the south and turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along. Well, in circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. See these regular observable cycles of nature that you can't miss. Man was created from dust and will return to dust, Genesis 2:7. So one of the things you're going to see, because some people say, well, Solomon's at odds with so much of the Bible. No, he's not. If you study this carefully, you'll see that he's not at odds at all with much of the Bible. He is talking about the very things that are set up for us in Genesis. Then the Lord God formed man of dust from the ground. Very sophisticated dust, but dust nonetheless. Well, your body is comprised largely of water, to be honest with you. It's very much water. But the chemicals that comprise your body will easily break down back to their constituent things, and you will, given a death and enough time, you will decay and become a part of the planet again. And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of lives, and man became a living being. Also, Ecclesiastes there, where Solomon acknowledges this, is 12:7. And this is all a command to remember him, and it's talking about the ravages of old age, and then finally, the death. He uses very poetic language here to describe death. The silver cord is broken, and the golden bowl is crushed, and the pitcher by the well is shattered, and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was. And the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now see, that goes beyond what man under the sun can say. Now he's brought God into it at a level that he didn't have him in the earlier part of this book, as we'll see. See, God placed the spirit of life within man. That's our two verses we just read, Genesis 2:7 and Ecclesiastes 12:7. God ordained marriage, divine institution number 2, for the blessing of man, Genesis 2:18. And while man has not necessarily always handled this well, it still is a principle. And as much as possible, we honor the divine institution and we honor God, who created it and established it. And the Lord God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. By the way, if you read Genesis 1 and 2 there, this is the first time God says something was not good. Everything was good, 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 very good. And then here, not good. First thing. And what is not good? Loneliness. God doesn't see loneliness as a good thing. I will make him a helper suitable for him. And so he fashions the woman there from the rib of man. And there are lessons in all of this too. We can't stop and do Genesis and fill you all in. But there are lessons here as to why he creates Eve out of the rib. And what Adam says, and the nature of, again, separation under verse 24, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother. What reason? Divine institution number 2, marriage. And be joined to his wife, and they become one flesh. And also, so God ordained marriage, Ecclesiastes 9:9. Solomon acknowledges this. He's not opposed, certainly wasn't opposed to marriage, was he? Apparently not. Ecclesiastes 9:9. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. So to stay in a loveless, fruitless marriage, that's not a reward. That's not happiness. It's not what God intended for man. Even Solomon acknowledges this. So the idea here is while we support the divine institution and uphold it, at a certain level, we can't force people to stay married. We're not going to try to. God ordained marriage for the blessing of man. E, at the fall, the environment was subjected to futility, in which man was forced to necessarily share. Because a part of the environment, you can't get around it. Now, man is not cursed, but the earth is cursed. And the cursing on the earth is recorded for us in Genesis 3, 17 and 18. Cursed is the ground. The language of cursing, and I point this out because people talk about the curse. God does not use the language of cursing with man or woman. He provides correctives for what their STAs are going to need, but that's not a curse. Some people view authority as a curse, to something to be avoided at all costs. Whereas for the woman, her salvation in life in some ways is geared towards submission to authority. As we saw that in Timothy. That came across loud and clear in 1 Timothy 2 there. Genesis here, 3:17, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it. And toil emphasizes the unpleasant aspects of work. It's not just that you work. There's work that's pleasant and you don't mind doing it and all of that. And then there's toil, and it emphasizes the unpleasant aspects of work. When it's hot and you're sweaty and it's awful out there and you wish you were dead, that's toil. All the days of your life. Oh, that sounds fun. Both thorns and thistles it will grow for you. Goody, goody. I need a lot of those. And you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread. And this is the corrective for man's STA, is to work and to work hard. That's a part of man's salvation, is to work and work hard. A part of his phase two deliverance is to work. This is the corrective for his STA. What if man didn't have to work? Think of all the trouble people get into because they don't have to work. And they don't have to take the time and make the sacrifice and all of that. It yields a very frustrated and unhappy person. Why? Because this is against the divine order. It's against the divine order for man not to work and support himself. Because from it you will return to the ground, because from it you were taken, you are dust, and to dust you will return. And so Ecclesiastes 1:2 talks about all of this vanity. The supreme vanity. He says it twice here. The supreme vanity, says the preachers. The supreme vanity. All is vanity. And that word hevel, we'll get into that and deal with it. It has some subtle nuances which are important. And in Romans 8:20, that was the one we read, where the creation was subject to futility. Again, that same word. F, the principle in toil and futility is a direct result of the fall. The verses we just read there, Genesis 3:17 through 19, and Ecclesiastes 1:3. What advantage does a man have in all his work which he does under the sun? So what do you get at the end of it all? What's the big payoff, the big prize, the grand and glorious jackpot, Charlie? What do you get? The chocolate factory? No. You don't get anything. You die. That's what you get for all your work. And for all your work, what you do, how long will your work last? Who knows? But it'll eventually crumble and fall. What were the greatest buildings in our country in the 1800s? They're not the greatest buildings today. And should human history go another 1,000 years, it won't. But if human history went another 1,000 years, where would the great structures of today be? I mean, some structures withstand time at some level, but they're all subject to the ravages of time. The Sphinx doesn't look like it did when it was first created, or the pyramids even, but they're still there. But they're built out of rock. And all of that, that will withstand the ravages of time. It's a better level, say, than other things. So, again, the principle of toil and futility is a direct result of the fall. Also, Ecclesiastes 2:11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. I wasn't any better off for all my hard work. What do I have for all my... Is there profit in hard work? Well, at some level, sure there is, if you get paid for it. But Solomon wasn't even getting paid for it. He was just doing it of his own accord. And also verse 20... And I love his conclusion in verse 18. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. He sounds happy, doesn't he? For I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor, which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. Therefore, verse 20, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. I hated it. I despaired. Again, not a real happy camper. And Solomon holds this up and says, look, this is the way I was. I was a miserable, unhappy person because I came to realize the hard way that nothing satisfies. So if nothing satisfies, where, that begs the question, where is satisfaction to be found? Where is contentment to be found? Can it be found? This begs these types of questions as he deals with this. And if you read it and you just take it on the surface, oh, well, this is horrible. He's right. I'm just going to shoot myself in the head and get it over with. I mean, if you read it and took it all at face value here and nothing else, never delved any deeper, said, why is he doing this? I mean, this would encourage you to suicide as you read this. And I don't think that's his purpose at all. So, death is becomes a certainty as a result of the fall. Genesis 2:17, which was the warning given to man, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And actually, it's better translated a tree of good and evil knowledge. These are adjectives that define the word knowledge. It's good and evil knowledge. You shall not eat from it, for the day you eat from it, you will absolutely die. You will surely die. The Hebrew expression, dying, you will die, is an emphatic way of saying it's a certainty. You can't get it. It's like the double negative in the Greek, oume. Absolutely cannot happen. In this case, absolutely will happen. You will die. Now, Adam didn't die physically. We know that. He lived another 930 years or so. But he did die that day. Spiritually, he died. This human spirit was executed. And also 3:19 we see there, this is the first thing we see of physical death now. And that's, you know what, that's actually supposed to be 3:20. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 3:19, yes. Because you're going to die. Because from it you were taken, you are dust, and to dust you will return. And then in verse 21 we see the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife. What we're not told there is animals had to die for that to happen. I mean, you have to be able to figure that out. And if he made garments of skin, where'd he get them? And here you have, Adam and Eve believed the gospel that day as it was presented to them. They believed the promise of the Messiah, the seed of the woman. And that's all they had to know and believe. And they exercised faith that day and they were saved. But now they're saved living in an imperfect environment. And now they've got a sin nature. And so things are really going to change. But this deal here, this demonstrates the substitutionary sacrifice. This illustrates it as an innocent animal died now to cover them, to provide covering for their sinful activities, as it were, to cover their bodies specifically. And so you have here the idea also of imputed righteousness as he covers them with something that's not theirs, as he just gives it to them, these skins, and he clothed them. So you have in miniature here, you have a lot of doctrinal issues and a lot of theological things going on in these verses that, again, if you just casually read them, you'd think, well, big deal. So what? He made some skins for them. That's all it means. No, there's way more going on. So death becomes a reality. We see the first death actually was Adam's, and then the second death was in animals, or two animals maybe. And then Ecclesiastes here, 8:8. No man has authority to restrain the wind with the wind, or authority over the day of death. Now, death is a guarantee, but you don't have authority over it. You don't know when you're going to die. I don't know when I'm going to die. And there is no discharge in the time of war, and evil will not deliver those who practice it. Now, see, that's the older Solomon writing, telling you some things. That look, you may prolong your life with evil, but it's not really going to work in the long run. I'll tell you that. Also, chapter 9, verse 3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun. There is one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil and insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. That's a simple fact. You can't get around it. Everybody dies. I mean, absent more revelation like the doctrine of the rapture, which we have, which Solomon did not have. That was a mystery doctrine relegated to the church age. All men die. And that's what you see out there under the sun as you observe the world. Every generation that's come has gone. Every man that's ever been born has died. And that's it. I mean, obviously we have biblical exceptions like Enoch and Elijah, who were taken out apart from death, which typify in some way the church. Under typology, taken out apart from death, delivered, in Enoch's case, before the flood. In our typology, we're taken out just before Daniel's 70th week, or right as it begins. So Ecclesiastes 9:3, and H, the fall of mankind results in the introduction of evil via the formation of the genetic sin nature, Genesis 3:22. Therefore, then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us. And I believe, if I remember my Hebrew here, I'll have to double check it, I think this actually can be translated one of them, knowing good and evil. And then now he might stretch out his hand and take from the tree of life and live forever. So the man has now entered into a fallen condition. As we know, that condition continues on, Genesis 6:5 here, talks about the nature of that condition as existed in the antediluvian era before Noah's flood. And then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Just as in the days of Noah. Yeah, that's where we are today, just about. Man is a pretty evil creature at this point. And as we know, we're promised evil times will come, difficult, dangerous times. Because men are lovers of themselves. They're just so filled with themselves. Also, 8:21. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. This is confirmed in Ecclesiastes 7:20. Also, wisdom strengthens. Let's see, where are we at here? 20. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. You're not going to find that guy. He doesn't exist. And so this is the nature of man, and you just have to understand it and recognize it and accept it at some level. Men are evil. They've got genetic evil within them that they will pursue. Also, verse 29, behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they sought out many devices. 8:11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly. Therefore, the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. And 9:3, again, that was one we just read. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil and insanity. And insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. And so this was one of the challenges. I've had people come at me, you know, about other pastors and this and that. Well, he did this, he did that. Well, guess what? He's insane. How's that for you? He's still the pastor last time I checked. And you're no less insane than he is, by the way, so don't be so self-righteous. You've got the same evil and insanity within you that everybody has. And that doesn't change anything. Don't you think Nebuchadnezzar had some insanity in his heart? Oh, sure he did. And God humbled him, and of course, ultimately, he was positive, and ultimately, he believed. Nebuchadnezzar, what did he have to do? Well, he ended up having to become a bull, or at least thinking he was a bull, for 7 years and eating grass. Well, God humbled him. But you got this evil and insanity in the heart, and you just have to recognize it. And that's just the way it is. You're not going to get around it. You're not going to find somebody that doesn't have evil and insanity in their hearts at some level. It's just how to deal with it through doctrine becomes the issue. And then Romans 5:12, here we get the mechanic Paul sets forth for us, confirmed in the New Testament, the types of things we see. But now we have further revelation and greater explanation of how this all comes to pass. Romans 5:12 and following, therefore, just as through one man, the one man is Adam, the sin nature, again, not sin generically, the sin nature entered into the world. And spiritual death came as a result of the sin nature. And so, therefore, spiritual death spread to all men. The latter part of this verse is not translated well. Not because all sin. That makes it sound like you got the sin nature by sinning. It actually says upon which all sinned, or in which circumstance all sinned. Because of which all sinned. Not because all sinned. You had a sin nature when you were born. And you hadn't committed one personal sin at all. You couldn't commit sins till you become conscious of yourself. So, again, it's not translated well there, but we see the fact that spiritual death, and actually there was, again, an order of events. Adam sinned. Adam's sin happens, point one, we might say. Now, this all happens instantaneously like this. But there is a logical sequence of events. Number two, the flesh is judged by God. Number three, the genetic sin nature is formed. Now, I can allow for two ways this happened. Either there was something in that fruit that genetically altered the nature of mankind, or Adam's sin, and I lean towards this one, Adam's sin was imputed to the body that brought it forth, that created it, and that formed the genetic sin nature. Adam's flesh then became sinful by the imputation of sin. That's what I believe. Then after that, now that he's got a sin nature, he dies spiritually. So this is the fourth in the steps that actually occurred. Now, Adam's sin, in a sense, results in this down here. I mean, obviously that's what did it. But there was a mechanic to it and a way it happened and an order in which it happened. And so spiritual death, genetically, you got the next step. Genetically, this goes to all men. That's the fifth thing, we might say. So now all men are born sinners. Again, apple trees don't produce apples, but they don't become apple trees by making an apple. They make an apple because they're an apple tree. You don't sin. You sin because you're a sinner. You're a sinner by nature. You can't get rid of that nature. Now, 1 John deals with that at length, that if you say you have no sin nature, well, you're an idiot. Or if you say you don't sin, you're an idiot. Either way, you're an idiot. But if you buy into any of that. So here we see death spread to all men, out of which or because of which state all sinned. The sinning comes about as a result of they're spiritually dead and they sin. They don't die spiritually by sinning. So there, again, there's a mechanic and an order to it. So the fall of mankind, again here, results in the introduction of evil via the formation of the genetic sin nature. Four reasons may be presented here as to why Solomon presents such a dark picture of life, filled with so many seeming contradictions, inequities, and finally death. One, first Solomon was demonstrating that life apart from God has no real meaning. It only leads to dissatisfaction, emptiness, and fatigue. And you look at people out there. If you could go out and interview people, how have you found life, you know, if they're 80 or 90 years old? And people, you know, they seem, you know, some of people want to live forever. God, I know. Pass. Life can get, you know, and that's a horrible aspect of life, that the essentially the dead linger in a state of living death. As we'll see, physical death was one of the best things that could have happened to mankind. Can you imagine living forever with your sin nature and you can't get away from it? That would be hell. That you can actually finally get away from this monster in the resurrection. Two, Solomon here secondly acknowledges that much of life cannot be fully understood. We have to admit, the greatest believer and the most wise man admitted that he didn't fully understand everything. And if he didn't, where does that leave us? And the idea is, so this would emphasize the need for believers to live by faith and not by sight. If you're going to live your life based on what you see under the sun, well, you're walking by sight. And what are you going to have if you live your life that way? Well, you're going to come to the same conclusion, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. So again, I think there's some underlying things here that one needs to consider. Why would Solomon do this? Well, I think one, it's to point men towards God, and two, it's the necessity of faith. That, hey, look, we see all this horrible stuff out here, but we don't despair because of it, because we know God has a plan, and that he's got it all under control. No matter what people do, let the heathen rage. Why do the heathen rage? Let them rage. Third, like Job, Solomon provides a balance with the sometimes unqualified optimism of traditional wisdom literature. Therefore, he examines a world that is unfair, beyond one's control, and not fully comprehended. And so you'll see some what we might call apparently biblical contradictions. Proverbs 13:4. And by the way, recognize Solomon wrote both of these. So, the soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, but the soul of the diligent is made fat. Fat being a symbol in the scripture for prosperity or prosperous, we might say. Fat means you got more than you need. And you compare that, however, to Ecclesiastes 2:22 and 23. For what does a man get for all his labor and his striving, which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous, and even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. So even if you're diligent to go out there and work, he says you get nothing for it. But then Proverbs says you get fat. Now which do you get? You're going to have to stop and do some thinking about this. Proverbs 8:11 also here in this regard. For wisdom is better than jewels, and all things desirable cannot compare with her. So if you could have wealth or wisdom, which would you have? Well, nothing's more important in life than your health, right? Or health or wisdom, which would you rather have? Well, according to this, you'd rather have wisdom. There isn't anything you can compare to it. But then you compare that with Ecclesiastes 2:15. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? What's the point? Well, is wisdom more valuable than folly becomes the question. Is it just as well to live your life as a fool or a wise man? This begs that question. If you had a choice, would you rather just be a blithering idiot? Or would you rather have some sense about you? Also here can say Proverbs 10:6 say, blessings are on the head of the righteous, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. The memory of the righteous is blessed. And then you compare that with Ecclesiastes 8:14. There is futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it appears, to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say this is futility. So it says God blesses you if you're righteous, and he says, I've seen righteous people that aren't blessed. Is that true? Well, sure, you're going to encounter that. You're going to encounter inequities and unfairness out there. And this, and what would this do to a young person? This would tell the young person, yes, God blesses the righteous, but sometimes that doesn't happen right away. Or sometimes it happens the opposite. It isn't always just you be righteous and everything will fall into place for you. It doesn't work that way. Solomon acknowledges a world that doesn't work that way. So if you take these verses in Proverbs and try to make them, oh, this is true all the time. Well, no, it's not. Even Solomon would contradict that. Well, fourth here, Solomon affirms that one significant aspect of true happiness consists in the principle of contentment. Taking proper enjoyment in the things that God has provided rather than striving after the wind. And what do we see in our world? You talk about a book that is appropriate for our time. There is so much lack of contentment out there. It's never enough for people. Again, it reminds me of the movie Wall Street. You see all these biblical principles illustrated if you look around. The world is full of wisdom. Wisdom shouts out all the time if people only knew where to look or how to look and how to listen. When is it enough? It's never enough. I've got to have more details. I've got to have bigger, better, on and on and on. And we've covered all that there at the end of Timothy, where Paul says, look, tell these people to not get bogged down in the pursuit of the details of life. All right, our time's up. We are going to have to stop there, and we'll continue here Wednesday evening. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. We thank you for the spiritual information that you continue to provide for Positive Volition, and pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.